Thank you, folks, very much. I'm Tom Ivester, and I'm an alcoholic. Great to be here. Thanks for the invitation. Thanks for sticking around. I didn't know why you stayed until I ate the meal, and that was great. That was first class. Just really good. I won. You guys got good beef in Iowa. You don't send any of it to North Carolina, I've noticed. What do you do, send leftovers out there? Really is first class, and it's good to see all of you. It's good to see a bunch of old friends and a whole lot of new ones. And I do want to thank you sincerely for the privilege and pleasure of being here. It's a great honor. I want to thank you for the hospitality. And I don't mean just the people who sort of drawn the short end of the stick and got appointed to take care of us. But all of you, one of the good things about being last on the program is that you can wander around in relative anonymity. And, you know, once you get through, you know, Bill has been besieged by autograph seekers ever since Friday night. And when you're last, nobody knows you. You know, you just sort of wander around and talk. And it's just been great to get to know a bunch of you guys. And it really has just been super, the hospitality. I've never been to Waterloo, Iowa before. I've never been to Cedar Falls, Iowa before. And I've really had a marvelous time taking the scenic tour. Ten of us hardy souls, I believe it was, yesterday, loaded up in Verge's van with dark gangster windows in the thing. In a beautiful spring day in Iowa, cold, wet, foggy, nasty, we went on a tour. And somebody would say, there's something over there. Couldn't see a thing. I mean, nothing. That's great. You guys are really lucky. You've got some cultural highlights here that just knock your eyes out. There's a 3 John Deere plants. I thought that's what you wrote to a jilted lover or something. Bob tells me that they'll kick out almost 100 a day of those things. I'm impressed with that. I'm telling you, that's just impressive. And Dean, and we'll be sure you understand who I'm talking about. Dean is an absolute authority. He's one of the construction experts on the new hog refinery, or whatever you call it out here. He's proud of that thing. I'll tell you, it's just state of the art. Doing 600 hogs an hour. I still don't believe that. So it's been great. You know, I've seen every side of the Cedar River. And it's been great. You know. Every time I turn around, Gary said, let's go eat. I know, you guys really do it up right out here. It really has been super. I've just thoroughly enjoyed it. And love the informality and the friendliness, the genuine enthusiasm and unity that's been so obvious in these two towns. And so I do count it a pleasure to be here. Hope to see many of you again. Now, basically, what I want to do is tell you as much as I can of my story. We say we've only got one story, and I guess that's true in a way, in the sense that history doesn't change. But I'm constantly amazed at how much the story does change. And it's not that the story changes, it's just that my perception of the story and my understanding of the story and what's on my mind at a given time. Today, for some reason, I just got on my mind, I'd like to just sort of get down and dirty and tell the story. I'd just like to tell a story. I don't particularly want to make any point, except that I have enormous gratitude and tremendous respect for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a fellow who is truly a fortunate man. I came into this program a little over 32 years ago, when I was a 24-year-old piece of human wreckage. And the miracle happened. And I found a brand new way to live that's taken me far beyond anything I ever dreamed. And I want to share with you basically how that came about. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who knows full well that an alcoholic can indeed find a new way of life here that'll last him for a long, long time. That I can actually stay sober as long as Russ Cassidy. That's almost. I just live that long. Rapidly becoming one of our real, real senior members of Alcoholics Anonymous, an old friend of mine. This program can last. And that's kind of an important thing to me, because sometimes I get the impression that our program is growing, to be sure. It's like this conference. It strains the walls of this hall. We're growing. My impression is that we've got more people coming into Alcoholics Anonymous than ever before in our history. And frankly, I think we've got more people going out of Alcoholics Anonymous than ever before in our history. And my impression is that we've gotten to the point that we take such numbers in that we don't give the kind of loving attention, the kind of real strong message of how sobriety occurs that it takes for us to hang on to and find a new way of life. And one thing that reminds me of that, I had an experience a while back. A young fellow came up to me. I spoke at a meeting down in North Carolina. And a young fellow came up to me after the meeting and said, I heard you last week up in Pennsylvania. And first thing I assured him was that I didn't speak at every meeting, so it'd be okay to come back. And he said, I didn't get a chance to talk with you, but I wanted to thank you for something you said. And I said, well, what? He said, you mentioned that you had been sober since you came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that at that time had been 30 years. And he said, I can't tell you how much that meant to me. He was a fellow, he told me his story real quick. He was a fellow from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And he said that he'd been a sober 11 months. And in the group that he belonged to, he was actually beginning to wonder if there was something wrong with him, because he had not drunk since he'd come into program. And it looked like everybody he knew were in and out like a yo-yo. He said it meant an awful lot to me to learn that people can and in fact do get hold of this program and never have to drink again. Tremendous thing. And I made it a vow that I would never tell my story again without sharing with folks that fact. And if you're somebody who has found a good hold on this program, whether it be from the first time or from whatever point, I would urge to share that with people, because it is awfully important to know that this thing can and does work. Sometimes it takes just a matter of holding on. It's kind of like a story I heard that this young fellow called his sponsor one day and said, my world's falling apart. He said, I've gotten laid off over at the plant and no income coming in, and my wife learned about that and she's left, and I'm here alone and broke and miserable and scared to death, and I don't know what's going to happen. His sponsor was a wise man. He said, well, don't worry about that. You just keep on praying and going to meetings. It'll pass. A few weeks later, the guy called his sponsor back again, just as excited as a kid at Christmas, and said, man, you were sure right. I did what you said. I prayed and went to meetings, and don't you know they called me back from the plant. Not only gave him a job back, gave me a raise. And my loving wife learned about that, and she came home quickly. And this sponsor was a wise man. He said, well, don't worry about that. You keep on praying and going to meetings, it'll pass. You know? And how true it is. No matter how good or how bad, it ain't going to stay that way. It's going to pass. And I think it's awfully important when it comes to hanging on to sobriety that we have to take the long view. And there are times when all we can do is hang on. But it is tremendously important to hang on. And sometimes that's what I've done over the years, is hung on. But I'm a guy who is living proof that this program can and does perform miracles in human life. And that's essentially what I want to share with you. I don't know exactly why I'm an alcoholic. I go oversimplify it and say it's because I drank too much liquor. And I do believe that has a very important part to play in developing alcoholism. I've never known an alcoholic that didn't drink. Most of them, quite a bit. I never known one person who didn't get drunker than a billy goat. I never known one didn't throw up a lot. You know, they must be such a character, but I've never met one. So I know drinking has something to do with it, but I think there's more to it than that. My personal notion is that there are two things required. One is a receptive personality, and the other is booze. And I was a guy who had that sort of receptive personality. I was a guy who was set up with that sense of restlessness and discontent and maladjustment with life. I didn't like anything about who I was, where I lived, who I lived with, how I looked, how I felt, nothing. And I was an undisciplined guy. I was unwilling to accept my place in life. And I was not somebody who was willing to live within the limit. And so I was a ready-made guy for whatever reason. I had that kind of personality so that the minute I took a drink, the magic happened. And it was very important to me from the very beginning. I was a guy who drank too much from the very beginning. I got in trouble from the very beginning. I was a guy who never had any experience with anything that could be remotely described as social drinking. I think there is such a thing. Don't understand it particularly, but I know there is such a thing, social drinking. People who just drink with relative impunity. They drink when they want to, and they don't when they don't want to. They don't finish drinks. They have no respect for alcohol whatsoever. I really don't understand people like that. You know, my wife, I used to be crazy enough to go to the supermarket with her to buy groceries, and she likes a little wine. She used to like a lot of wine. And she likes... Right now, she's drinking wine cooler. That is the most disgusting thing. Well, anyway, God knows. But she'd drive me nuts and I'd go in the grocery over there, and she would... I'd try to nudge her down to the quality end of the wine rack. And she'd stop up there with that Rebecca Sunnybrook Farm or whatever. And I wanted to get her down to the Mad Dog 20, you know. God, the girl, she finally got so tired of me teaching her to drink that she's almost quit. Drink a wine cooler, she's almost quit, that's for sure. But there are people who drink like that, and they're just strange people. I've never in my life known the feeling that must be a good feeling of saying no thanks. I've never said no thanks when Gary dragged me kicking to another restaurant. I go. I'm that kind of guy. Yes. No thanks. I don't remember a time in my life ever turning down a drink. I've even heard members of Alcoholics Anonymous say that they turned down drinks because they couldn't get but one. They just soon not bother. I swear to God, I cannot identify with that. Now, I was the kind of guy that would walk all the way across Waterloo on the rumor of a drink. Yeah. You never know, you might get another one. Yeah. I've never known that feeling. I was not a social drinker. I was a guy that drank too much. I got in trouble, lost jobs, got in fights, got in jail, wrecked cars. I don't really believe it's an alcoholic. When I first got in the program, I used to think I must have been born alcoholic if I was, because I had that kind of crazy pattern right from the very beginning with excessive problem drinking. But I'm one who believes that there is a difference between alcoholism and any other kind of drinking. I think in the first few years of my drinking, first couple of years, in my 16th, 17th, into my 18th years, I was essentially a problem drinker. I was not a full-blown alcoholic. I think I was certainly in the oven, but I don't believe I was truly an alcoholic. I might have had some of the emotional things, some of the mental obsession, but I was not a fully developed alcoholic. In my 16th, 17th years, that's essentially what it was. I became alcoholic in my 18th year. Now, I certainly had no awareness of that at the time, but after I got in the program, got sober, looked back, it was clear to me that in my 18th year, those subtle but important changes occurred that distinguish alcoholics from every other kind of drinker. The definition that I like best of what happened to me at that point is the one that's in the third chapter of our book, in the chapter more about alcoholism. It's about the only thing in the book that I know verbatim. It says, we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. And I like that definition. It's a straightforward, no-nonsense, direct statement of what happened. We are people who lost the ability to control our drinking. It has nothing to do
with whether we're young or old, rich or poor, smart or dumb, male or female, gay or straight, none of that. It says we're people who've lost the ability to draw a record. And that's exactly what happened to me, although I had no earthly awareness of that until well after I was sober. But when I look back, that's where I could recognize that those changes occurred, where I lost the ability to control my drinking. And my story from that point on was like every other alcoholic I've ever heard. Now, mine was a little bit more chaotic and episodic than most. Mine happened in a hurry. I was a guy that was so busy doing it that I rarely, if ever, stopped to reflect on what I was doing. I was just sort of rushing from one thing to another. And it was the classic kind of thing of drinking too much, too often, and always at the wrong time. I was a guy that started to change in the way I drank. Now, even though I'd been a drunk, a guy who drank too much, I was essentially a one-night stand artist. After I crossed that line, that started to change. And I started to become aware that somehow or other, when it came to drinking, I was not quite like other people. I didn't drink like other folks. I drank more than they did. I drank faster than they did. I was the kind of guy that would sit at a table and finish his drink and wish somebody would reorder, but very self-conscious about it being me, because I was conscious of the fact I didn't drink like those people. I was the kind of guy that would drink on the way to drink. You know what I mean? I was the kind of guy that had to warm up for a party. I wrecked my car getting out of the driveway to go to the party. Pass out, wake up, and still be there on time. I was that kind of guy. I just drank more than other people. I drank different than other people. And I was self-conscious about that. I have actually left bars with groups of people acting as if I were going home, and then as soon as they get out of sight, I turn around and go back. That kind of guy. I started to be a little more selective, sort of a reverse snobbery. I started to seek out a sort of an inferior environment to drink in. I started looking for people who drank like me, and there weren't many of them. I started to drink alone. I started to experience blackouts. All of the things that happened started happening to me from that point on. And little did I know that my life, from the point that I went over that line at 18 until today, that my life would never be the same, in the sense that if I took one drink of anything with alcohol in it, I would get drunk. That's where I developed the disease alcoholism. And I'm one who believes that alcoholism is a disease. I don't think it's just a nice name to call drunk. I believe alcoholism is a disease. It's essentially a two-part book that refers to a three-part illness. I like to think of it in pretty solid kinds of terms. And I see it essentially that. It's basically a mental obsession coupled with that physical allergy. And the physical allergy is such that if I take a drink of anything, I'll get drunk. And I believe that's true of me today, even though it's been over 32 years, that if I took a drink in Waterloo, Iowa today, I seriously doubt that I'd get back to North Carolina. I know that on the evidence of my own experience. I know it through the tragic example of many of my fellows. I've seen people with more than 32 years in the program, and I know you have, Russ, who've gone and tried it, and I've never seen one succeed. Who on earth am I to think I'd be different? I've tried everything, from Vitalis hair tonics to VO. You name it, I tried it all. I even tried hydraulic brake fluid one time, inadvertently. I don't recommend that very much either. That's a lousy drink. Some enterprising drunk sold it to me for bootleg whiskey, and tasted about like some I'd drunk. It was effective. You know, I was locked up. God knows. Yeah. Well, same thing. You know, I'm not even sure that's intoxicating, but it sure did bring me to a dead halt for a while. That sort of thing. And then it was just over and over. And the story is always the same. Now, I don't know if it makes sense to anybody but me, but I'm basically a guy who sees alcoholism in terms not of the trouble that I got into out there. See, I don't measure my alcoholism by how many times I went to jail, by how many times I had my nose broke, by how many times I got divorced, by how many times I woke up in the wrong town, by how many times I wrecked cars. That's not the way I measure my alcoholism. It's not the trouble I got into out there, it's the trouble I got into in here. And when I think about alcoholism, the nature of the disease, what I remember is that alcoholism was, with me, an inside job. It's what happened to me on the inside. As I changed from a bright-eyed young fellow full of optimism and hope to a fellow who just simply couldn't function, day after day, drink after drink. It just became a series of, as Bill so aptly put it the other night, failures and fresh starts. Failures and fresh starts. And the thing that was characteristic of me is that every time I failed and started over, I settled for a little less and a little less and a little less. Until finally, after only 8 short years of drinking, I wound up living an existence that I didn't even know people lived. Living on the streets in the city of Flint, Michigan, city of 500,000. It was to reach a point that I was unemployed and darn near unemployable. If I got a job, I'd hold it for a few days, a few weeks at the very best, and then would get fired or more often just quit and not show up. That sort of thing. Just a young fellow with his life falling apart. I wasn't born to that sort of thing. I was born into a decent family down in North Carolina, and they were good folks. They weren't rich, but they were fine people. I wasn't born to live on Skid Row. That wasn't what my heritage was about. But that's where my kind lived. The most frequent address that I had the last year that I drank was a place called the Rialto Theater, and it certainly wasn't because I like movies. It happened to be the cheapest room in town. I wasn't born to do that, but that's where my kind slept when they wanted to get in out of the cold. I wasn't born to drink wine in an alley with a bunch of strange-looking people, but that's where my kind were. I wasn't born to sell my life's blood at $5 a throw just to survive, but that's where my kind lined up and what they did. Now, I never believed that alcohol would take me anywhere like that, but I was so busy doing it that rarely did I stop and examine what was happening. It was just a chaotic kind of thing. And what happened on the inside? And when I think back today to what it is that I don't want to live again, it's not those physical things happening. It's not the jails or the fights or the scuffles or that sort of thing. The thing that keeps me sober, and what is it that keeps me after 32 and Russ after 47? What is it that makes us hang on and pray God it'll be at least that much longer? It's not those things. I haven't thrown up for so long I've almost forgotten how. I used to be good at that. Very good. Now, I didn't even miss a drink. You know, I just go right at it and excuse me and do it. And now I'm just sloppy with it. You know, this. What did it make you hang on? It's not that kind of memory. Now, I like to remember what it was on the inside. The things that nobody in this world knew about but me. I like to remember, for example, the despair, the hopelessness and despair. I like to remember what it was like when I was 21 years old, that time in life when I should have just been getting started, and I can remember as a 21-year-old looking at myself in the mirror and wanting to throw up at what I saw, with that sense of impending doom, hopelessness, and despair. I pray God that I never forget that feeling, nor that I ever know it again. I like to remember that. I like to remember the fear. The fear, the nagging, gnawing, nameless, undeniable fear that was a part of my existence. I didn't understand it, but I knew it every day of my life. The kind of fear that used to wake me at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning and cause me to jump straight up for no reason. It's just the way I was. The fear that was my constant companion no matter where I went. Ran the gamut from mild anxiety to total panic. And it was always there. The kind of fear I hear talked about in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I hear one of my fellows sit in a meeting and talk about that cold knot in the stomach. That's what fear is about. I hope to God that I never forget the bitter taste of that fear, nor that I ever know it again. The loneliness. As we call this sometimes the lonely disease, and certainly that's true. There is a loneliness that I think is peculiar to alcoholics. And I think every human being in the world understands loneliness, experiences loneliness. Everybody. I'm sure there are people sitting in this room today who are going through excruciating loneliness. No question about that. So, if you want to see loneliness, talk to somebody recently divorced in middle age. Because who's having to deal with trying to regroup and reorient and reestablish relationships, who's trying to go through the awkward, fumbling motions of courting in middle age, whose partner just no longer is there. That's a loneliness. Talk to somebody recently widowed who's had their life mate just snatched away. And you understand loneliness. If you really want to get a look at loneliness, I had occasion to get in contact with nursing homes a while back. My mom had, before she died, she had strokes in one of the nursing homes. If you ever want to get a look at loneliness, suck it up and go to a nursing home. And listen to people who are imprisoned by their condition and maddened by the fact that they can't function. Yet they're still intelligent human beings. And I defy you to walk away from there with any sense of loneliness. So everybody knows it. But there's something peculiar about the loneliness of alcoholism, isn't it? That we call this a self-centered disease, and I think it is. I think that's the heart of this disease. Self-centered disease. And the loneliness that we experience is different. You know, like when my mother was in the nursing home, she knew that kind of maddening loneliness. But it could be changed instantly if I walked in the room. And for her, the room lit up. Or let one of her grandkids go in. My God. Yeah, and it was Christmas. Yeah, that's different. Yeah, that's about severed relationships. Ours has to do with an inability to function in relationships. One of my guys that I work with, and he spoke out here a couple of weeks ago, fine young man named Keith. And I love to hear him describe a thing about his family relationship and about loneliness. When he talks about coming in drunk and getting into bed with a wife and both of them lying there, stiff as boards, pretending to be asleep because they simply don't know what to say to each other. That's the hell of alcoholism. That's the loneliness of the few. It has nothing to do with whether we're surrounded by a circle of friends, loved ones, whoever. That peculiar loneliness of alcoholism. I drank my way into a glass prison, a drink at a time. And the walls of it were thick enough that I couldn't get out and nobody else could get in. Much more. That, you see what I'm talking about. It's an inside job. And that's the hell of alcoholism is what happened there. Now, I believe that without any doubt, I would have drunk myself to death if I hadn't been brought to stop. And I was brought to a stop many, many times. I was the kind of guy that went to jail with great frequency. And it wasn't because I was so wild and violent. I was just a kind of drunk that would wind up in the way all the time. And folks would just sort of haul me off somewhere. And I wasn't all that bad. I just had peculiar sleeping habits. So they had to haul me to jail. So I really don't know. I have no earthly idea how many times I've been in jail. A bunch. It's a relative figure anyway. It's not like it was 600 hogs an hour. That's important. Things important to me is that the first one and the last one look remarkably alike. I was never in one alike. I was never in one that didn't have cockroaches in it. And it was the same thing. What's important to me to recognize is that when I drink, I'm the kind of guy who has to be brought to a stop. That's the nature of me. And I wasn't brought to a stop enough. Because unfortunately, I stayed out there too long, and I stayed out there long enough to do the kind of thing that I think every alcoholic in the world fears doing. I've never met an alcoholic, not a single one, nor an Al-Anon, who hasn't gone through the excruciating fear that somehow or other, before it all comes to an end, there's going to be tragedy. That sometime I'm going to walk out and look at my car to see if there's dents and blood, and they'll be there. I think every one of us, I know that. Every one of us lives in that kind of morbid fear that we might do something, and we really don't want to do it. Most alcoholics deep down are sensitive people. We hide it fairly well, but basically deep down, I think we're pretty sensitive folks and really don't want to hurt anybody, and I was no different. Yeah, I always knew that I was capable of anything. But like every other human being, I knew that the kinds of things that I feared never would happen. And thank God for most people, those kinds of inordinate fears are bad dreams. But I'm here to tell you that for some, they're real nightmares, and I was one of those. I woke up in jail up in Flint one day. Jail I'd been in many times. Knew everybody that worked there. And after the wait for a little while, the jailer came by, a guy I knew very well. And I asked him when I could get out, and he said, I hope never, and walked off. And I had no earthly idea what the man was talking about. And then some of the other guys in there told me the night before, I'd been driving somebody's car down the main street of the city, and had run down and killed two people. And my reaction, I'm sure, was like anybody's would be. I know the mind has a tremendous defense mechanism, and it won't accept what it can't handle. And that explained my behavior to me. I just simply couldn't deal with it. I couldn't accept the fact. And then gradually came to know that indeed I had done more damage than any drunk ever ought to be allowed to do. And as a matter of the end, where do you go from here? How do you balance the scales between a street drunk and two fine young people with lives in front of them? Well, obviously you don't. The only time I'd ever been in jail, I didn't try to get out. I didn't want out. But I didn't know how to tell anybody that. I didn't tell them who I was. I didn't tell them where I was from. And somehow they found out and contacted my folks. And my mom came up July 17, 1956. I was released from that jail on bond, charged with manslaughter. Knew that I would not drink again. Now, some people say that if it ever gets serious enough, you'll quit. Not if you're alcoholic. And I didn't understand that. I knew that I would never drink again. I didn't think I could physically pick up a bottle. The guilt was too great. I stayed sober a day and a half, and then started drinking, of course. And then between July and November of 1956, I drank like nobody I've ever seen. I've worked with thousands of drunks over the years. I have never worked with one like me. And I've worked with drunks. I held a drunk in my arms while he died in my home county in North Carolina. And he wasn't a drunk like me. Even as he died, he was still protesting the fact that he wasn't like me. He was still fighting. And I just gave up. I just absolutely gave up and sunk into pathological drinking, trying to drink myself to death. That was obvious. And obviously it didn't happen. And November the 19th was actually the day that I had my last drink. Didn't realize it would be at the time. I knew it was going to be for a long time because I was to be tried that day. I finished off a little piece of a bottle of gin, went off the court. There was no intrigue about that. I knew that it was to be a one-way trip. I wouldn't be back. I had no defense. I had nothing to say. I couldn't even tell them what I'd done. They had to tell me what I'd done. I was obviously found guilty. It's an interesting thing to me. I don't know how many courts I've been in front of and how many towns and how many sentences all over the country. The only one that I remember anything about was that one. I remember the judge's name. I remember the day. I remember vividly the feeling. And I remember when that sentence was passed, I was given a max of 15 years in the state prison in Southern Michigan. And I knew what that meant. I was a street character. And going to jail was an occupational hazard. I mean, it's just one of those things that happened. Going to a penitentiary was a different thing, though. And my instinctive reaction, I guess, was a very natural one. It was one of fear, just an instinctive reaction, but almost simultaneously the most real sense of relief I'd ever known, because I knew it was done. It was over. There wouldn't be any more. And the next day I walked into that institution, and I was a fully resolved young man. I had absolutely no qualms. I was a guy that was just almost devoid of feelings. A hopeless piece of human wreckage, 24 years old, just being cast away. And I never believed that I would ever come out of that place alive. And I honest to God didn't care. I truly did not care. Little did I know, that was to be the land of beginning again. If anybody had ever tried to explain that to me logically, it could not have made sense. Because I never believed I would survive in that place. There's a saying that, I don't know if it's written somewhere or not, but it's a saying that I really relate to. What God would use, He first reduces to nothing. What God would use, He first reduces to nothing. And I doubt if there's anybody in the world that knows better what that means than us. They used to call this, Russ, I'm sure you remember the day, they used to call this the Fellowship of the Last Resort. This program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the Fellowship of the Last Resort. And it makes a lot of sense to me in terms of where we have to start. Yes, this program is not one that we find by reason or logic or because we deserve it or anything like that. Now, we're people who have reached that point where we have, in effect, died. And that's what it took. I had a 12-step call a while back on a guy that was on my anniversary, my AA anniversary. And I went in to see the guy. Call came, my wife took it. She was getting ready to take me out to dinner, which is what ought to happen on anniversary. Wives ought to do that. She wasn't going to cook, I knew that. The call came in. She told me who it was, and she said, "You're going, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah." And I went. I walked in his hospital room, and he was laying there. And I said, "Hey, guy, how you doing?" And he said what any drunk ought to say. "Oh." And I said, "You'll never know how glad I am to see you like this." And he said, "Oh." And I said, "You probably don't know what I'm talking about right now, but one day you will. Because if I had walked into his hospital room and he'd been laying up there with his legs crossed, reading the Wall Street Journal, puffing on a camel, I would have probably said, 'Hey, nice to see you. I'll catch you around.'" See, you don't deal with people like that. We deal at the point when God has reduced us to nothing. And then we're open to something new. Fellowship the last resort. And that's what happened to me. I was at the lowest conceivable point in my life. And I was interviewed by a little social worker one day. He interviewed me like many others had. Concluded like many others had that I was an alcoholic, that I had a lot of trouble with booze. And then he did something that had never been done before. I'd had a lot of people tell me that I ought to stop drinking. Some tell me I'm better. I never had anybody tell me how. And I honestly didn't know that people help drunk. I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. If I'd ever heard the words, I didn't know it. And this guy probably knew as little about Alcoholics Anonymous or alcoholism as anybody I'd ever seen. But he drew the diagnosis and he said, "We've got an AA group here at the institution and I think you better go." It was exactly the way he put it. It wasn't an invitation, certainly not an order, just a sort of a flat declarative statement. "We've got a group, think you better go." And I walked into my first meeting, February 2nd, 1957. Probably much as you walked into your first meeting. I wasn't real thrilled about it. I never wanted to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, really. Even after I learned it was there, I just sort of had this morbid kind of impression that Alcoholics Anonymous would be a place for a lot of worn out old dudes that had gotten too old to anything but quit drinking it. And I didn't want to get out and mix with people. I wanted to sit in my cell, stare at my navel, you know, or whatever you do. And I didn't want to mix with folks. And I walked in to that meeting. I've heard many people talk about their first meeting. Mine wasn't like many that I hear. I hear folks talk about the warm handshakes and loving acceptance and how somebody hugged them, and thank God nobody hugged me. I mean, it would have run me off. One guy spoke to me, had a correctional officer on the door. "I was for yes, sir, sit down." And I sat down, listened to the first AA meeting, first alcoholic I'd ever heard tell his story. And he was a guy that later became my first outside sponsor. His name was Shy Walker. And he was an absolute legend in the Midwest. He was in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Fine, fine man. One of the finest members of Alcoholics Anonymous I've ever known, and I've known some good ones. Crude little fellow, had about a third grade education. He was a state delegate from the state of Michigan back in 1957. Third grade education. One of the most genuinely loving, enthusiastic people I'd ever seen in my life. The day I listened to him tell his story, my impression was that the guy must be some kind of fruitcake. I could not imagine anybody telling a god-awful story like that for no reason. I mean, I just did not understand it. He's a very different man. I think the one thing that brought me back to my second meeting was not the identification with man. I never did really fully identify with Shai, not with his experiences. I think it was the spirit. It was the spirit of the man. And I'm one who has a genuine appreciation for enthusiasm. Yeah, that's one of the things I've liked about this conference. There's been a lot of work going on. It's like last night, Bill and I were talking about, after the meeting last night, somebody said, "Hey, let's grab the tables and chairs." And my God, we were fighting over them. We had eight people all in one table. You know, and it was great. You know, the spirit of enthusiasm is such an important thing. And that was important to me because I never was somebody that had truly wanted to stop drinking. I never wanted to be sober in my life. Now, all of you guys may have just been dying to get sober. Probably dying anyway, I never had any desire to be sober. I always thought sober was about a first cousin to rigor mortis. I couldn't imagine a more boring condition than sober. I didn't want to be sober. I didn't want to be drunk either. Yeah, I wanted to be in that marvelous little plateau that's about midway between. And I'll guarantee you, if I could have found a way to drunk at that level, that's where your speaker would be this afternoon. I'm not here on moral ground. You know, I just wasn't one who functioned well there. I was drunk. But I never wanted to be sober. And this guy talked about being sober different than I'd heard. And the enthusiasm of that man, I think, is what brought me back. You know, I've thought a lot of times, obviously, about what really turned the key for me. And I know that was one of the things. And I've thought back many times to what made the difference. And there are a number of things that I know turned the key for me. Yeah, I believe, on the one hand, I believe in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a program by which we can recover. And there's nothing mysterious about it. There's nothing really complicated about it. It's an elusively simple program, really. But it is a program. It's a program whose depths I have never plumbed. I'm a member of a big book study group in Southern Pines, North Carolina, and my weekly meeting is spent in pursuit of understanding what this program is about. And I've never plumbed its depth. But in reality, it's a very simple program. It's a program that offers a design for living, a design for recovery, a design for a new way of life for any alcoholic who wants it. And it demands, the toughest thing I've ever done in my life is to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because what I found in this program is that it's not something that we take like a blueprint and do. It's a surrender to a new way to live. And the elusive thing is the simplicity of the program. Simple, but very demanding. A lot of times we say we don't know what makes it work. My God, anybody could figure out what makes it work. The steps have got about 200 words in them, and any fifth grader could define them. What really turned the key? I think that's one aspect. But when I really get down to it, to what made the difference with me, I'm reminded that this is a people program. Our founder used to use a term, we've got a new book out on it now, called the language of the heart. The language of the heart. And I think when you get right down to it, what makes this program work, and certainly what made it work for me, was that simple fact, the language of the heart. When I look back and try to put my hand on it and identify what it was, I can't help but think that I wasn't somebody who just found himself in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a guy who was carried into this program on the shoulders of giants. The shoulders of giants. There were a group of people who got sober in the 40s and early 50s that I think were truly special people. Now, I can kind of understand Bob and Bill and Ed and all those guys in those early days who sort of blind leading the blind. But then in the 40s, when the news got out that there was an answer, there was a literal avalanche of alcoholics who came in. And there were across this country, including Waterloo, Iowa, people who rose to the occasion. There were some people who grew to the task and took on the awesome burden of putting our program into effect around the world. I was privileged to be 12 steps by some of those people. And many, many times I wonder how well we're picking up that torch, how well we're carrying it out, how well I'm giving that same quality of treatment to the people with whom I work today. Yeah, there was a country singer. I've noticed you guys use more country music up here than we do in North Carolina. It's pure country. And there was a singer. I used to hate country music. And I've got so I'm very fond of it. And there's one singer that I especially didn't like. There's a guy they call the Possum that suddenly got a clothespin on his nose. George Jones. He just thought. Sorry, and now he's one of my favorites. Anyway, he had a song that he put out a while back. And the name of the song said, "Who's Gonna Fill Their Shoes?" Who's gonna fill their shoes? And he was talking about the stars of country music, you know, with Roy Acuff and all those guys. And when I hear that song, it reminds me of the same question here. Now, who's going to fill the shoes? Because we're losing a lot of those people. We've lost many of them already. We just lost a man in my home group who had 48 years of continuous sobriety. Who's going to fill the shoes? It's us. If they get filled. And that's the kind of people. And they're not necessarily talented people. They're people with hearts as big as all outdoors. And let me just share with you a couple of when I think about why I'm here. And you could probably find the same thing if you've got a hold on this program. I remember Shai and the tremendous impact he had on my life. I remember how much his enthusiasm, how much his spirit, how much his genuine dedication meant to me. I remember him. I remember another fellow from Battle Creek by the name of Glenn Coffey. Great fellow. And he used to literally attack meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with a missionary zeal that put Billy Sunday to shame. That guy just could not contain himself. And when he spoke, you just came to the edge of your seat. No matter what you wanted to do, he just was one of those kind of galvanizing people. He cared so much. I remember a little Indian fellow by the name of Johnny Snow. Johnny was a guy, he was a dishwasher in a restaurant. And somebody told me about Johnny when I was active in the group, and I invited him to come down and speak to a meeting. And you know, getting people to go into institutions is not always the easiest thing in the world. But there's a special breed who respond to that, and Johnny was one of those. And what I learned later, Johnny Snow, the illiterate Indian dishwasher, had left home about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning to make a 60-mile trip to a meeting that started at 1 in the afternoon. And the reason he left so early was because he was going to have to hitchhike to get there. And just in case his luck was bad and he didn't get a ride, he wanted to have time to walk. Now, I can't tell you what Johnny Snow's speech was that day. He didn't make a speech. What he did was gave more than he had. I've heard practically every powerful speaker in Alcoholics Anonymous. Never heard a stronger message. I remember time. I remember what that meant to me. I remember a fellow by the name of Pete Slater. He's a guy that, I'm not making you cry, Gary, I'm making me cry. That's what I'm doing. He promised me, he threatened me that I better not make him cry. I remember that guy, and I remember Pete Slater. He's a Hollander from up in near Grand Rapids. He's in Muskegon. And Pete's a guy, he's still living, great big Dutchman, probably 6'4". A very formidable man. I used to think he scared me so much. Very, very tough looking guy. And he's a sort of bitter man in a way. He's got more love than anybody you've ever seen, but he's sort of got some bitter things. When he was 15 years old, he had his right eye kicked out by a prison guard. And he's never really gotten past all that, but Pete Slager is a man who found this program. Hear this. For almost 40 years, Pete Slager has traveled across the state of Michigan to carry the message. Still does, to this day. Because I was there. Because I was there. And I'm sure others saw it the same way, but that's what I saw. Message that I couldn't argue with. Many, many, many more. Yes. A lot of people think that in order to be effective, and I'll tell you about one more, that in order to be effective in carrying the message, you've got to have some god-awful experience that will tie in, particularly an institution. I hear lots of guys say, oh, geez, I can't go to an institution. I wouldn't have anything to offer. Never been there. For God's sake, don't let that slow you down. One of the things that I think is fundamental to working with institutions is to recognize that if you're working with guys in an AA group in institutions, you're working with alcoholics, not convicts. I don't know anything about Convicts Anonymous. I know about Alcoholics Anonymous. The first guy that ever got through to me in a way that I actually identified with and related to was a guy that had never been in jail in his life. Somebody had talked this guy into coming in one time. Thank God he came once. He was a furniture salesman from Detroit by the name of Lewis. And I don't think he knew where he was going, because when he got there, that was the scariest man I've ever seen. And the whole time he spoke, he was looking around to see if anybody was sneaking up on him. And he never came back, but he came one time. And that was the first guy that I ever identified. I could identify with the fear. I could identify with the feelings that this guy had. Tremendous thing. You know, in case you ever do wonder about that, you know, I used to sort of gently resent people who came into that institution, and I understand why they did it, but people who would come into the institution and feel like they had to speak the language. You know what I mean? Speak the language. And would deliberately sort of tell the raunchiest side of their story. To quote, speak the language. And I used to kind of resent that because, and you can see why when you stop and think about it. You know, a week in a prison has the same number of hours as any other week. It just seems longer. There's 168 hours. And for the average guy in prison, the AA meeting that he goes to is one of the few spots of decency in the entire week. He's got 1 hour in which he can listen to somebody talk sensibly about hope and a new way of life. And I really didn't much like it, and don't to this day, when people come in and foul up the only decent thing in my life. So when you go into an institution, if you go, yeah, I tell you what I do. I dress a little more carefully than I do anywhere else. I speak a little more carefully than I do anywhere else. And I don't try to speak anybody's language. I carry the message there, same way I do anywhere else. Now, I'm fairly cautious about my language anywhere, but just like you today, I look around this room and I see people here with their wives, their mothers, their children, coming together to take a look at a new way of life that might give hope where there's desperation and desolation and fear. And I hope that in the span of this hour, I can offer something a little bit more constructive than just a bunch of off-the-wall garbage. If my mouth still sounds like an open sewer after 32 years, I need to take a hard look at what it is that I'm really about. Now, I don't want to ever get so goody-goody that the message goes over the head. But it's been my experience that toughness in reality doesn't separate from decency. And so, you know, there's a time and a place for getting stuff off. When you go into an institution, if you go, and I hope you will, remember that the message that's going to mean something is the one that's designed to share with alcoholics. You just might carry it to somebody. And that, a lot of guys like that who came in and shared that sort of message was the thing that made the difference for me. It gave me the hope that maybe, just maybe, there was an answer here for me. And I started trying this program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am so thankful that I started trying it in Jackson Prison. And it worked for me there, as well as it ever has anywhere. To the extent that I spent 42 months in that place, never missed a meeting, and I found a brand new way to live there. I finished that prison sentence without a mark on my record, nor a mark on my body, nor a mark on my soul. This program literally saved my life there. It gave me a new way to live. And I knew when I left there that I wasn't going back. I knew that I had found what was to be the answer for me. And I gave my life to this program, and it gave me back, just like what I said in the beginning, a brand new way of life, new and different than anything I'd ever seen. And when I'd left the institution, I had some fool's dreams that, you know, God only knew what would happen. And I knew that I had not magically become some highly marketable commodity just because I'd been in prison for 3.5 years. But I wanted desperately to hang on and find something new. I wanted something decent in life that I never had. I wanted a job. And I wondered if I would ever be able to find honest work for an honest day's pay. I wondered if I would ever be able to have a friend. One. If I did, it would be more than I had. because there was not one single person on the face of this earth that could honestly call me friend, nor that I could call friend. Not one. Other than just some old drinking buddies. I wondered if I would ever be trusted to do anything for anybody. And those were legitimate fears that I had. And I'm very pleased to report to you that it's been affirmative on all counts. I was able to find a job when I got out of the institution. It wasn't much of a job, sweeping the floor in a textile mill on night shift, 10 at night, 6 in the morning. And I was the most grateful floor sweeper you've ever seen. Loved it dearly. Didn't like the job, but it was free and it was decent. It was honest. I was very grateful for that. I found some friends. The first night I walked out, walked back into my hometown down in North Carolina. I went to a meeting the first night. There were 12 guys at that meeting. 12 men. There weren't any men, women in the program back then in my area. When I walked in, I was wearing that funny looking suit that they had given me to go home. And anybody who looked at it could tell I had either just gotten out of something or off a boat or something. I was a strange looking dude. And I guess I could tell you that it made a difference. And it did, because normally when you walk into a meeting brand new, you may get half the folks to greet you. And it made a difference when they took a look at me, because every man in there stuck out the right hand. And I knew I was home. I knew I was where I belonged. And that experience has been replicated thousands and thousands of times. And today I do have a friend in every city in the state of North Carolina, in every state in the United States, and I'm talking about people that I know personally and care about deeply. Same guy. Every province of the Dominion of Canada. Good friends. People who care about me, who would get mad if I went to their town and didn't get in touch. People that I care about. Reunion with the human race. I think one of the greatest things that's promised in our program is that we'll not only know freedom, but we'll know a sense of useful purpose. I've been very active ever since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still am. I'm the busiest man I know, bar none. And I'm a guy who believes in this program. I'm a guy who's had some tremendously good breaks. I'm not somebody who's suffered through, even though it's a tough job, I'm not somebody who's suffered in sobriety. I'm doing better than I've ever done. I make more money than I ever stole. I make about, really, they could get me for about half of what they pay me for my work. Now, I don't say that in North Carolina much, but it's a fact. I tell you the darn truth, but I do it for nothing. But I make pretty good money for a guy like me. And I want to share this one miracle with you that along that line. Yeah, I still held the job sweeping that floor in that mill 2 years after I was out, almost 2 years. I was afraid to change. You know, I'd done other things and I could have gone into sales or stuff like that, but I wasn't going to do anything that was shaky. And one day I was sitting in my home, got a telephone call from a state capitol. A guy identified himself. He was a man I met one time at an AA meeting that in a prison group that I sponsored. And asked for Mr. Ivester. I got on the phone and he said who he was. He said, "Mr. Ivester, we're thinking of expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system. We were wondering if you might consider accepting a position." I had never been offered a job in my life. I mean, not even a job, unless by some drunk that didn't have one. And he was a guy talking about a major position in a prison system in a professional kind of role, and I'd never done anything like that. And the first thing I said was, "Man, you know who you're talking to?" And he said, "Yeah, probably better than you know yourself." And to him I said, "My God, I'd rather do that than anything in the world." To myself, you know what I said, there ain't no way. Never been an ex-con in history hired and that sort of thing, and I knew I wasn't to be the first. But lo and behold, in November of 1961, I was in fact employed as a rehabilitation supervisor in the North Carolina prison system. Been there ever since. For the first 7 years I did basically just treatment, rehabilitation type stuff. And then in 68 I started to move into management, and in 1970 I took over my first institution as warden or superintendent. And you know, I wasn't a guy that had a lot of hidden talent. You know, I mean, I wasn't somebody that was just discovered who had all kind of great potential. I'm the guy I just acquainted you with. And the only thing I had to sell was the fact that I found a brand new way to live in this program. And I had done some things in you know, while I was in prison, I completed a couple of years of college, and I had some stuff along that line. And so, you know, I had certainly done some things to get somewhat prepared. But basically, it was the fact that I found something new here, and they thought I had something to give. And so I moved in, somewhat reluctantly to be sure, but I moved in and became head of an institution. And you don't think it's a long way from a cell in Jackson Prison to being warden of a correctional institution. That's a long trip. You can't, as a matter of fact, you can't get there from here. It just doesn't happen. Every once in a while, thanks very much. Every once in a while, he's sitting in some sort of a major meeting and we talking about laws or some whatever, budgets or something. And I'll get that old visit from insecurity. And I can't help but thinking about, you reckon they know about me? And almost expect somebody to speak up and say, hey, what are you doing in here? Get out of here. But it doesn't happen. And a year and a half or so ago, I got a real good opportunity to move out of that kind of thing and then into setting up a first-class program for drug and alcohol in our system. That's what I'm doing now. I'll finish out my career doing that. That's been a grand career. And the day I retire, I will immediately go to work as a volunteer, and they'll learn that they could have got it for nothing all along. I share that story in the hope that if there's anybody here who may be like I was at that point, just totally devoid of hope and wondering if there's any place in this world that you can make it, maybe that will give a little bit of hope. That, yeah, and I'm nobody special. I'm just that kind of a dude for whom this miracle happened. I gave my broken and wasted life this simple program, and it's taken me places I obviously wouldn't have dared dream going. As I mentioned, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not a used to be member. I'm one who believes that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous lasts as long as I use it and not another second. The minute I quit functioning as a member of this program, quit actively working this program in my life, then I used to be a member. It lasts me as long as I use it. And for that reason, I do some things that are pretty fundamental to me. I maintain active membership. I'm a member of a home group. I'm one who believes that everybody's member is nobody's member. I believe in home groups. I believe there's a place in this program where I need to sit down and be counted. Where somebody says, where is he if he ain't there? They go looking. Where when it's time for the work, they call on me. Where if there are financial problems, they're my problem. Where I start to think a little broader than just me and my well-being. And I start to be actively concerned about other people. Yeah, I am a busy man I have the privilege and I think the obligation to do what I'm doing here today a very great deal. I do this most every week of my life somewhere. And even though I spend a lot of time doing this, I do it simply because somebody told me that the only obligation I had in this program was to pass it on. And that's what I'm doing here today, is to pass it on. But this is not my greatest contribution in AA. Now, there ain't no real hardship in this, coming and speaking to a bunch of delightful people in Waterloo, Iowa. There ain't no hardship. And I really question whether it's bedrock kind of courage. You know the greatest contribution that I make in this program? I'm a meeting animal. And I don't mean that I'm just somebody that bounces from meeting to meeting, but I'm a kind of guy that sort of wanders around meetings and looks for people that ain't with it. I've done it here this weekend. I know that there are people like me who don't really feel that sense of joy and freedom and peace and belonging that's so vital. What I do is spend an awful lot of time introducing people to Alcoholics Anonymous in a local meeting. I'm the kind of guy that likes to make meetings be effective. And that's what I do. I've done that here this weekend too. That's where my greatest contribution is. It's not in doing the glamorous things of the major offices. It's in that quietly going about, being a constructive link in the chain. And this thing has worked for me tremendously well. I'm a pretty happy fellow. I live in that little town of Aberdeen, North Carolina, and it ain't much of a town. It's kind of like she's saying about this group bigger than her high school, and I know what you mean. This convention's almost big as my town. It ain't too much off of it. I've got a couple thousand folks there, and that ain't much of a town, really. But it's my town. That's where I live, Aberdeen, North Carolina. That's my home. And I'm a citizen of that town. That means a great deal to me. One time, I was not a citizen of anything. I was a number in a facility. Today I'm a citizen. I vote. Always wrong. I vote anyway. I pay taxes willingly. Sort of. They don't have to come get them anymore. I just take it down there. We're early every year. I'm on the school council. I'm concerned about the issues in my community. Yeah, I live there. I'm a citizen. And it really isn't much of a town, but it beats the devil out of that 9x7 cell. I'm grateful for that. Member of a family. Yeah, I have a wife, a little girl that I met in Canada almost 24 years ago. Conned her into coming to North Carolina in 1968. I experienced one of those things that you hear about in the program, but and some of us find it, some of us don't. Now, I never had known truly how to love. I knew the words, but I didn't know what it was like to truly love another human being unconditionally. And I had the experience of learning to love that little Canadian girl better than anything. And what a beautiful feeling it is. And then that great experience of asking her to let me be her husband. Not for her to be my wife or to take care of me or entertain me or do my laundry or do my cooking. I've learned that love's not something you fall in or find. It's something you give. It's an expression. And I had that beautiful feeling and still have it of loving another human being. And wanting to be her husband with the full realization of what that title means. I was at one time an absolute alley cat. I knew about using and abusing and slick talking and all that. Today, that gal trusts this former alley cat totally. And the real miracle is, I deserve it. I deserve it. That's what it's about. You know, in this program, let me just sort of close with this note. Yeah, I believe that I'm so glad to see the togetherness here and the Al-Anon activities. Lorraine last night was the finest Al-Anon speakers I've ever heard. That was just great. I'm a great believer that in this thing that as a family we either experience recovery that's complementary, that we either each go through a recovery process in a marriage or else we drift apart. That's been my experience. And my wife, even though I was sober 11 years when we were married, is an active member of Al-Anon today, and it enriches our marriage immeasurably. I believe in that, and I really believe in this family atmosphere here. It's been a delight to me to see the little kids run around. They've been remarkably orderly, too. You guys have done a great job of taking care of the kids. I'm glad to see them here. I'm glad to see them orderly, too, now, because sometimes it gets kind of wild. But that's great. That's what this is about. Yeah, I believe in that sort of thing. I believe there are places where we alcoholics must act in privacy and where Al-Anons must act in privacy in our own closed meetings. But I believe there are also places where we complement each other. So I'm glad to see that. I'm a guy truly blessed. I'm a guy who's had dreams come true that I never dared have. A guy for whom this program has provided absolute mountaintop experiences. I've been so high on the mountain that my cup literally ran over. And I've been at the bottom of the barrel, in the middle of the valley of despair. Because that's what I found about this program. It doesn't give us smooth sailing that's unfettered and free of bumps. What it does is gives me the ability to live life like every other human being. And there are mountains of ecstasies, but there are also valleys of despair. If there weren't any valleys, there wouldn't be any mountains. And that's what it does. Give me the ability to live here free, with responsibility, with occasional bursts of joy, and with a sense of genuine purpose in this thing called life. So whoever you are today and wherever you come from, whatever you bring here, whatever your hopes and dreams, I hope for you the very, very best.
We hope you enjoyed this recording. Please check out our website at sobrietytalks.com. You can also contact us by sending an email to sobrietytalks@aol.com. Thank you.